everyone, it's Hiba, and this is Kerning Cultures. While we're working on our summer season, we're going to be dropping some bonus episodes into your feed every now and again over the next few months. So that's what today is all about, a special conversation featuring producer Alex Atak, whom you've heard telling you all these stories, but you probably don't know much about him. So this is his backstory like you've never heard it before. It comes to us from our friends at the Dimiri podcast, which is a show hosted by Tore and Miri, where he has these deep, honest conversations with what he calls unique individuals. Alex is a unique individual. We love the show, so we thought we'd play the interview, slightly edited, here. Okay, here it is.
Welcome to the episode 15 of the Miri podcast. I'm your host, Tariq Al-Miri. Great. Now, this week's guest is Alex Atak, spelled with one T. Alex is a photographer and a radio producer based in the UK. He's also a managing producer for the podcast network Kerning Cultures, which has a variety of amazing podcast shows, both in English and Arabic. Alex is one open book, with lots of experiences and amazing observations. His insights in the world of storytelling are fascinating. He has had many busy years working on assignments for clients such as Monocle, The New York Times, NPR, and The Guardian. In this Tedriza chat, Alex and I really go deep into podcasting and why it's so different to any other storytelling form. We also discuss Alex's memories of growing up in Dubai, photojournalism's rite of passage, telling stories from and about the Middle East, the UK's colonial past, Alex's creative process, the history of tattooing, and plenty more. Let's do it.
How are you?
I'm good, yeah. I'm feeling pretty good, yeah. I'm feeling like, you know, when you kind of finish a year and the start of 2020, I feel like the start, like in 2019, there was a lot of stuff happening in my life and moving around and like various projects and all that. And it was super nice to just put that to bed at the end of 2019. And I do feel like I'm starting I've just moved to Brighton. And I feel like I'm starting a new like kind of chapter in my life. We've just moved into a new flat. Mm-hmm. So I'm feeling, yeah, pretty good broadly.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Shall we start at the basic intro?
Yeah.
Who are you, Alex?
My name's Alex Atak. I'm a producer at the podcast Kerning Cultures.
So it's not Atak, it's Atak.
You can pronounce it how you want. I'm really not fussy about it. When I was at, most people say Atak because that's the like that's the word that
and
we
you
know
take that
in English
lightly
already.
You don't feel that
don't
it
care,
is
I don't care I say Atak,
but it is with one T, so it is different.
One T, the thing about it is that I get like a lot of people think that it's like a name that I've made up for myself. Like some kind of stage name or something.
Yeah.
And like I've had people know me for like a few months and then they've been like, oh wait, that is your real name. And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, oh, I thought you just gave yourself that name. Like, you think I'm the kind of person that would like give myself a name? Like it feels like so self-involved. Whatever you want, Atak or Atak, I'm not fussy. No one says it right. Producer at Kerning Cultures, the podcast, and photographer.
Growing up, mm-hmm. I'm trying to picture this. It's almost like a classic story when you think of, you know, specifically Dubai. Mm-hmm. You think of an expat from England starting a family there.
Yeah.
Was that your story? Was it that kind of classical?
I think it's pretty typical. I mean, my dad moved there in 1983. To work for the airport. He worked at Gatwick Airport as a ground staff, like, you know, in the control tower or whatever. Or whatever. He's yeah, he did work in the control tower.
It's a very exciting job in 1983.
Yeah. So he got this job offer to move to Dubai and work on the ground staff in Dubai Airport when it was, I guess, the first phase of the airport, 1983. And then my mom, she was a flight attendant on British Airways flights.
That's crazy early stage. It's not like Dubai 90s where like everyone knows the tower and there's lots of advertising. It's like 83.
Like that weird turning point in Dubai history where it was kind of going from, it was past the point of figuring out, you know, the independence and the like, you know, the, going from the Trucial States to the UAE and the Seven Emirates coming together, and it was forming its identity as a place that, you know, I guess, I think at that point, I mean, historically, this might not be totally accurate, but I think oil had kind of been discovered around Dubai. Like, it was much bigger in Abu Dhabi, but in Dubai, I think they kind of realized they had some oil, but not enough to sustain an economy for years to come.
This is telling me very interesting things about your dad. Like, he's quite revolutionary and a risk taker, because it's not like, it hasn't happened yet. It's like, Dubai is like, it's like, what is this place kind of situation?
Well, I think the thing with my dad was he was brought up in a mining town in the north of England called Shirebrook, and his dad was a miner, his granddad was a miner, his brother wasn't a miner but stayed in Shirebrook his whole life, and so he was the person in the family who left, and he moved to London when he was sort of young, you know, in his early 20s, and went to college in London, which was a big deal, you know. Like, he could have, I mean, this was the time when the mines were kind of, they were changing, and working as a miner wasn't something that would guarantee you a job for life in the same way that it used to be. And so I guess that wasn't as much of an option for him as it would have been for his dad. So, but still, I mean, I think it, you know, he sort of was expected to stay in Shirebrook and build his life in the north of England. But he, moved down to London, which I think was quite a big deal. And then moving to the Middle East, moving to the UAE, was an even bigger deal, I think. So I don't know, like, I look at my dad now and he's like, I don't see the kind of like the spirit of someone who would pack up and leave the UK and move. You know, he's just a dad to me. Do you know what I mean?
It was a pragmatic thing, you think? It's just another job.
Well, I think I don't know. It's hard to tell. He doesn't talk about it. You know, my dad's really hard to penetrate. Making documentaries and making, being a photographer and all of that is like, you never know when you're going to come back to stuff later down the line. And so I have a ton of, like, I'm working on this project now, a photo essay kind of project, archival thing about the UAE and about when I lived there and my using my family's, photo archives and all of that.
Your dad's in particular.
Yeah, my dad's in particular. And I'm coming across, like, I'm going back through all of my photos from, you know, my years of living there, and I'm finding stuff that I shot that I didn't like mean anything at the time, or I just, you know, but now it has like, you know, years and years down the line, it has like a whole meaning.
This particular form, however long it lasts, however long it is going to trend, it does allow multiple layers of understanding that not many forms allow for, like video or social media in itself, or like very constrained small stories written.
I think audio has like, there's like some kind of weird intrinsic understanding that we have as people, I think, with audio, where like, if to me it feels sometimes like video can give too much away, it can be too literal, and some documentary filmmaking can feel too on the nose. I think because documentary filmmaking involves all of this, you know, like, it involves a lot of equipment and it involves a lot of theater around it and a lot of process around it. Whereas I think audio can feel different because it's, you forget that you have a mic in front of you. Firstly, you feel you always feel less guarded, but then I think it's,
so there's no performance either.
I feel like that sometimes when I'm interviewing people, you feel like, their guard is down a bit more. And also I think that from the audience perspective, I think that like audio has this way, we as people have this way of understanding the emotion behind people's voices in a much deeper way than we think we do. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can just like a pause in somebody's speech, or the way they breathe, or the way they kind of structure their sentence. Like, there's so much in the way people speak that we don't realize, and it isn't just speaking. You know, when someone's reading a script, I don't know how, but you can just tell. You can tell so much about, you know, if somebody's telling you a story, and you can tell where the emotional parts of that story are by the way they break in between the sentences, or just by the way they're breathing. And I think that's like so like awesome about audio. That's what I love about it. It's like super, it's super emotionally charged, you know, much more than we think it is. I think it also like, it just because it gives you more space as well, like there's more space to tell stories. I think it does. There is space to let people get their points across in a way where they can do it on their own terms. Do you know what I mean? And we often deal with tricky characters on Kerning Cultures where we don't like them as people all the time. Okay. But at least it gives them the space to get their point across, and like, who are we to judge whether or not somebody's decision making was right or wrong because it's specific to a time or a place and whatever. And I do think that that's what audio is really cool about. Like, there's a lot of space to get like nuance of character out, which you can't do in a documentary that has to, you know, that has to stick to a certain time limit to keep people's attention, or in a written piece that has to be under a certain word count. I don't know. To me, there's something cool about it. And that's like, I get that a lot listening as well. Like, my favorite kind of podcasts are not the ones where I agree with everything and I know the story and I love the person I'm listening to and all of their views are the same as mine. I probably listen to way too much content like that, but there are some stories like that I've listened to and you're like, this person is like horrific, but this is a new type of person that I didn't know about their thought process before. Like, this is maybe a clumsy example, but there's a podcast called Love and Radio. I don't know if you listen to it, and they do these kind of long form character studies. And there's an episode called The Red Dot. Have you listened to that one?
I need to write it down. No.
It's basically about a sex offender. It's about a pedophile, and they got a lot of like flack for it because, I mean, they gave a pedophile a platform, which is, that's very debatable in media as to whether or not that's a right thing to do, but
it makes you a bit more informed of how they think and what happens.
Not that I think in any way that we should be sympathizing with pedophiles, but
no, in terms of understanding the world around us, not necessarily like, oh
yeah,
I know why you did this. No, it's like, oh, okay. These elements take you to that place.
Totally.
Essentially. But
and I don't think that would have come across in a documentary video. He would have, like, it, I don't know, there's something about audio that medium works.
I think that, having a camera on your face, which we're doing now, one on your face, one on mine.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of forgetting about it. But.
but in a good way, because we're exactly looking at each other, it's a different setup. But when it comes to documentary, you feel like you got to perform. You feel like somehow you're being judged. And at the same time, as an audience, you feel like the spotlight is on this person, especially if they're profiled to be a bad person. Pausing all that and going back to Dubai, you can go a particular year, a particular moment. I mean, it's infamous for their very daunting hot summers. Maybe that's not the interesting time of year for you, but like...
Well, I didn't spend any time there in the summers because I finished school in June or no, like May or something.
It's amazing. So you get the best of both worlds.
And then my dad would stay in Dubai and work over the summer.
Okay.
Bless him. And my mum would take me and my sister back to the UK and we'd stay with family. Oh. So like, I didn't really know what like Dubai summer was until I moved there as an adult and I was like, this is what people were talking about.
That's good. It's a good way of splitting
universe. But then I also thought the UK was this like beautiful warm place and I had no idea how bad it gets, you know, because we haven't spent any time there in the winter.
So your parents engineered your perception of those words very nicely.
Yeah,
it's but very, like, yeah. If you pick a day from your childhood memories, just to paint a picture of how that was like, activities, family gatherings, social, education, what was Dubai like for Alex?
I mean, we lived in a... So, I mean, up until... My memories of Dubai are, you know, before it really hit the boom years, you know. So my kind of early memories of Dubai are, you know, we lived in Jumeirah, which is a kind of low-rise neighborhood. We lived like a five-minute walk to the beach and my school was just down the road. And so we lived this kind of very... It was like a quiet life, which is weird to say because Dubai is the opposite of a quiet life now. But we did live like a very quiet life when you were weekends camping on the beach or camping in the desert or just spending the day at, you know, at the beach or having barbecues in the back garden. And like, it was a very, I think that's what my parents liked about it. It was a very quiet life. You know, it was very...
Is it because of that timing or is it because your parents managed to carve a certain bubble?
No, I think it was that time in Dubai. I don't think it was known as the place where you can move to as a foreigner and make a lot of money and live in a nice expensive high rise and stuff. Like, it was still like you got hardship pay up until the early 2000s to live in Dubai because it was considered a remote like place that you wouldn't necessarily want to move to. But I think that suited a lot of people just fine. And especially the old set of foreigners that lived there, I think a lot of them, they lived there for that reason, that it was quiet and it was.
But so for you, it's a really nice, relaxed environment where there's I wouldn't say nature, but there's relaxation, open space, beach, barbecues, good friendship, very consistent. And at that same time, it's not Dubai where people circulating every 2 years, going back and forth. You had friendships.
People were there for the long haul, really. Yeah.
Do you have friendship with locals as well?
No, that's the weird thing. I wasn't friends with any Emiratis until I left school, until I was an adult. Because there were none in school?
There
were no Emiratis in my school, no.
Oh, okay.
Like, we had a lot of English, American, Pakistani, Indian.
What kind of school was it?
It was a British curriculum school.
Okay.
Other Arabs from Syria, Lebanon, whatever. But
so no, 100% expats from all over.
I would say my school was 100% expats. Maybe there were a couple of Emiratis. I didn't know them though in school. Mm. So I didn't make friends with any Emiratis until I went back to Dubai to work when I was 20 or 21.
But how do you make a sense of that place? Because I have nephews who live there at a very early age. Like, we're talking your childhood age now, 8 and 7. And it's exactly that. International school, people from all over the world. I don't 100% know, but I'm assuming 80% of their network is that.
Yeah.
It's people who are from the outside.
How
does that shape your view of the land and the country and the culture?
Yeah, I think,
or is that something that's not really in the mindset yet?
Well, I think it's like, I don't think I considered the UAE to be, it sounds really weird. I knew that geographically it was in the Middle East, but I didn't consider that I was brought up in an Arab country until I was older, because I just, like, you know, Arab history, Middle East history, Emirati history was kind of at the peripheries of our life as a foreign family. You know, I went to a British school, we learned British curriculum. It was a bubble, total bubble. And so I only really got interested in the history of the UAE when I moved back there as an adult. And so as a kid, I mean, like, I probably didn't have that different of a life to growing up in the UK. Like, aside from, you know, being able to like play football every weekend in the, you know, cause it was sunny, and like, you know, being, I think they create, like, the British curriculum school system created a bubble for me and for my classmates.
It's very busy, very full on.
Yeah. And all my teachers were British, basically. Like, it's very, you get the sense that you're living in a, I think I had the sense growing up that I didn't, I mean, I knew that I didn't live in the UK, but like, I didn't have the sense that I grew up in the Middle East either. Like, I don't speak Arabic now.
I mean,
Arabic growing
up.
For
me, it's a sense of exploration of a place, not necessarily being critical at all, because I had a similar experience of living out of homeland, essentially.
Yeah.
Like, I was born in the US very early on, went back to Libya to my primary education, elementary, is in Libya. The later stage, 12 to 18, was in Morocco, but in a Libyan school. So sort of parallel to you, Dubai, British school.
Yeah. You live in Morocco, you're not going to have a social life if you don't interact with Moroccans, right?
Yeah.
The UAE, like, I think what is it, like 15% of the population are Emirati, maybe less? And so you can, like, you can totally go.
So
your life
from a numbers game, it's not an option, basically.
Yeah, but also, like, you kind of don't. You're not forced to. Like, when I moved to Beirut, I was forced to pick up. I was forced to pick up basic Arabic and forced to learn to. I don't know, just forced to, like, you know, most people are Lebanese, obviously.
So
you kind of assimilate much quicker because you just, like, you have to, otherwise, you know, you're not going to leave your apartment.
You'd be completely isolated.
But that doesn't happen in the UAE. Like, you can literally live, you know, I'm sure I know plenty of people that have lived there for years and years and have never had a meaningful conversation with somebody from the UAE.
So to compare it at the same time to jumpstart where you are today, you're here in the UK, we're in London at the moment. Your parents consciously wanted you to connect to the homeland, culture, and also give you a reference of another reality, the real world, whichever one you want to choose.
Quote unquote, the real world.
Of like, things work differently somewhere else. And they, along with every summer, you were shipped off after university to come here, or like earlier than that? Or
It got to 2006, and those were really good days for Dubai, especially for, you know, that was after they passed the law that foreigners could buy property. So a lot of my parents' friends were buying their houses for very, like, really cheap for what they're worth now. But my parents didn't want to risk, they didn't have the savings to do that. They didn't want to, like, risk buying a house and then finding it was worth nothing. So they had this kind of decision of, like, either we go all in and stay in the UAE, or we don't and we leave. And I think a big part of that decision making was they didn't want to raise me and my sister and my brother by that point. He was born in 2000. They didn't want to raise us in a, you know, in a bubble, essentially. They didn't want to raise us in that bubble that I was just talking about, because
they wanted to shock your system.
Yeah, but because what comes with that bubble is a lot of like just privilege and a lot of not a very good understanding of the rest of the world, of where you come from, and
take things
rightly,
for granted.
They didn't want to raise us to take things for granted and to be entitled or anything like that. And I think at the time it was the worst move they could possibly have done, because I loved my friends and my life. And, you know, it's that age. I was 13. So I was just I don't want to go to the UK. The UK sucks. Like, so they moved us back. And
plus, it's difficult. Even if it was something else that's even better, it's a tough transition at that age.
Yeah,
that's,
totally.
That's your world.
Yeah, totally. And I hated my parents for doing that to me. I hated living in the UK for the first year or two. But they moved us back. And I went to, we moved back to a relatively normal town just outside Bristol called Chepstow. Went to a state school and lived in a relatively normal town.
And your parents moved with you?
We all moved back, the whole family. And my dad got a job in the UK and all that. So, and it was a huge shock to my system. But it was a needed shock, you know, because I'm super grateful they did it, because, like, now, I mean, I'm friends with, I'm still friends with a bunch of people that I grew up with going to school, and they grew up in Dubai their whole life. They didn't leave. And they're just like, they don't have like a very good, and I'm talking very specifically about people who were raised in the British curriculum, British, like, expat quote unquote bubble in the UAE.
And they're still
they're still there. They, you know, a lot of them work in marketing or finance or, you know, something like that now. And a lot of them, they just don't, like, I'm sure they'd admit it themselves, they don't have a good idea of, like, I was talking to a friend recently, a year ago in the UAE. And he was like, you know, dude, I come back to the UK now, and I don't know how to get on a bus. Like, I don't even know what clothes I'm supposed to wear in winter. Like, I don't know how to use the underground. Just, and it's like unbelievably naive stuff where I'm just like, dude, that's so sad. Like, you, and I don't blame people for that. Like, it's a very, you know, if you're earning good money in the UAE, like, it's a fine life to have. But,
but
I can see why it's easy to stay in that bubble, but I'm glad my parents forced us out of it.
I think I sympathize a bit with the dressing situation.
But yeah, that's the kind of thing that it can produce in people
if you don't
know anything except the UAE, except Dubai.
It's not 100% symptomatic of the UAE. It's symptomatic of having never left your environment for so long to experience another reality and accept that things might work differently and things might even change in the environment that you're living in. And it's, you mentioned, like, the whole time we're talking about two different Dubais, your parents' initial experience and then what happened afterwards. And that happened to you as well. So you had a long stretch here studying. You went to uni here to
I went to Falmouth to do, the course was called Press and Editorial Photography. It was basically photojournalism.
Nice.
So I moved back here in 2006, went to high school and sixth form here.
Is that inspired by your dad taking up photography?
I think it was, my dad was a photographer in some sense of the word, but a very loose sense of the word. He had a camera that he used, and he took pretty good photos, but he wasn't like a professional or anything like that. I got into photography. We went on a family holiday to LA when I was about, I want to say I was about 14 or 13.
Hmm.
And my mum thought I might be interested in going to the Getty Museum, which is a big, at the time they had a big photojournalism exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
Me and my mum went to that, and it completely blew me away. It was, it was a big retrospective of, you know, all of the greats like Henri Cartier-Bresson, like Brassai, like James Nachtwey, like every photographer of note from the last 100 years was in this exhibition. It took over the whole gallery. And that was, I remember that being the moment for me where I was just, I was like, oh, so you can use photography in a way that like means something, and you can like tell stories with photography. And I remember, I mean, there's a whole, we can talk about this later. There's a whole kind of other set of complexity that comes with this, but my, you know, my very naive 13-year-old brain, there was a big wall to wall, like as long as the living room here, you know, so a good like 20 feet long spread of James Nachtwey's photos. And they were all intense close up black and white photos of a an operating theater in an American air base in Afghanistan. And they were just, they were so in, super intense. It was, you know, like people's, people undergoing surgery, literally. So, and I remember looking at that and being like, oh my God, like this is, I don't know what this is making me feel, but this is like crazy that you can do this with photography. And so I think from that moment I was like, I think I was like, this is kind of, I mean, we can talk later on about the idea of being a conflict photographer and a war photographer, but,
that's on the list,
quote unquote. Yeah. But that was the moment, at least when I realized that you can use photography to tell stories and it can mean something and it can be that, powerful. So that, that was when I took up photography after that.
What was the first sort of set of photos and first camera on that
holiday? I used and I think I had my dad's old film camera, and I did a little series of landscapes about around Malibu Beach. There were a bunch of old dilapidated houses which didn't match my expectations of Malibu, and so I had this very sort of basic naive idea of doing a series of landscapes about about abandoned houses in Malibu. So I did that on my family holiday. And they're really bad. Like, they're really bad photos, but like it was a...
No, but your instinct of like, yeah, everyone's focused here, but there's a story
there. Yeah, very basic, on a very basic level. That was my instinct, I guess,
That's the reality of how most interesting stories are. Like, where it's sort of the path of least...
I mean, I wouldn't give myself that much credit at 13 years old. I think it was just whatever, but...
I would. Like, instincts that strong are not to be dismissed, to be honest. But like, on that point that you keep bringing of this whole celebration of certain types of photographers on your course, I think a lot of them used to come and talk and discuss their experiences. Not by virtue of how they're speaking about it, by virtue of how maybe the program celebrated the idea of someone going out there to the world to just, you know, take it apart and explain to the rest of us of how things went down. And that might have been exciting for you at the time, but now you feel a bit different. The sort of like, in another way, outsiders looking into a different country trying to explain a situation to people here, or, you know, the Western world, whatever label we can stick on that.
I have a lot of feelings about all of this, and I think this is what I spend the majority of my time thinking about with my work, because, you know, I'm from the UK. A lot of the last few years of my work has been in Lebanon and in the UAE, so, you know, the majority of my work is from an outsider's perspective. So
insider, outsider, it's much more complicated.
I could call myself
more
of an insider if I spoke fluent Arabic. I think that's, for me, that's the big thing, where I don't feel like enough of an insider because I can't do interviews in Arabic.
But it's as you have a step plus than someone who's just back today to go explore.
I mean, like we mentioned, you know, I still was brought up in geographically in the Middle East, but in a bubble within the Middle East. So I don't really consider myself to have any sort of special insider knowledge to the Middle East, and I kind of doubt people that do as well. I mean, aside from people who are very, very experienced correspondents who have lived in a place for an extremely long time, I'm a bit skeptical about people who are Middle East, quote unquote, Middle East experts. The course I went on in Falmouth, it was a photojournalism course that focused very heavily on the classics of photojournalism. So Robert Capa, Henri Cartier-Bresson. I mean, I'm naming people that maybe are not familiar to non-photographers, yeah. but these are people who were known for their covering wars and covering conflicts and covering other countries.
I'll probably know the generation after, you know, like Guy Martin.
Guy Martin was, or, yeah. So Guy was one of my tutors at uni. Yeah.
Michael Christopher Brown.
Yeah. Tim Hetherington. And so my course was a very much a photojournalism focused course that spent a lot of time, and I think it's changing now, but I think it spent a lot of time celebrating white men who worked in countries that were undergoing conflict. Yeah. And at the time that was the Middle East, because this was 2011, 2012. So it was,
everyone
was covering Egypt and Libya and then, Tunisia and yeah. So I went into my course and keep in mind that I had this feeling that was the way to become a legitimate established photographer, was to go and do this kind of old school style, National Geographic-esque, foreigner parachuted into a country, telling the rest of the world the truth of what's happening on the ground. That was the very naive idea I had of this is how you become a respected and successful photographer or journalist or anything, because those are the people that I was looking up to, that I was kind of funneled into looking up to. I don't blame the course. It's how the photojournalism industry is in general. It celebrates, it's changing again. I keep saying that, but I think it is starting to change. But I think it traditionally has always celebrated this idea of the foreigner who's willing to put themselves at personal danger to get the story or to get the picture. And I try and say this without criticizing the photographers themselves, because I have an enormous amount of respect for people who can do that and people who can, people who are willing to do that and put them, I have so much respect for, I had Guy Martin for a tutor. Guy Martin, wonderful man, wonderful photographer, who was, he was severely injured in a mortar attack in Libya. Yeah,
the same one that killed...
The one that killed Tim Hetherington and... Yeah.
Injured Christopher Brown as well. Yeah. They're all together, yeah, Misrata specifically.
So that story was super present in my first year of university, because Guy had just... You know, he was back from Libya and he'd recovered, but he was our tutor.
Mm. Just a little caveat, actually, but the last season's ending episode was with Osama Al-Fituri, who was their fixer. He was with them. Yeah. So he witnessed first account of how they were working in a different form and how each of them had their own sort of instinct. So it's an interesting one. I might translate it. It's in Arabic. So there might be a lot of references to journalists that worked in that time, because Osama dealt with a lot of... their key moments there. But there, it's very interesting that you have the fresh, I don't know how far off, because I know it really played a massive toll on Guy's mental state of mind.
Yeah, like, I mean, he talks about it a lot in our course as well. I mean, no, actually that's probably not right. He didn't talk about it a lot, but it was something that was always at the surface of our understanding of him, and
it shaped his experience.
I think a lot of the young men who started that course, there were quite a lot of young men on that course, had this, again, maybe they had this idea that they wanted to work as conflict photographers, whatever that term really means. I mean, that's kind of a outdated term anyways, but I think having him as a tutor, like, kind of gave us a much better understanding of like what that actually means to be a conflict photographer. And Guy talks about this a lot, and he has a lot of fascinating interviews where he talks about how he feels as though photography was using him and he wasn't using photography at that point, and he was and his relationship with photography was misbalanced. And so I think I took a lot from that, having him as a tutor in the first year of university. And it just made me think a lot about, man, like, if this is a career path that I want to pursue, like, what's the toll that my family has to take for that? Like, I don't want to, I don't want to be someone that puts my family in the situation where they're worrying about the work that I do, you know? And do I even want to do that? Like, is it even worth, like, the stories that I want to tell and the kind of documentaries and whatever that I want to produce? Like, do I, is that really what I want to do? Or is it because I have this kind of, deep rooted kind of, respect for, an admiration for the classic war photographers and conflict photographers. And I still think about this a lot, man. Like, it's still, you know, I still have this thing where I think of all photographers who have covered conflict as much more, they're on another level than any other photographers. Like, they've sacrificed for their work. And I still have a ton of respect for that. It's just not me. When I left university, those are not the stories that I want to pursue. That's not the style of work that I...
That's
and it came to a test, man. Yeah. I didn't tell you about this before, but sorry.
No.
The reason I know where I stand with it now is because I was... When I lived in Lebanon, I got an assignment to do a story in Syria in 2019, early 2019. So, you know, after much of the... at a point where Syria was somewhat... like accessible and somewhat safe, I guess, for journalists. And I got this assignment and I said yes to it. And in the time between saying yes to it and like applying for visas and stuff, I had the worst anxiety. I couldn't sleep and I never really get panic attacks. I had panic attacks. I was so on edge for that week. Just worried about it and worried about what happens if we get stopped at a border and we don't have the right papers. What happens if we're in a situation that we don't know how to deal with and our fixer can't help us out? What if we run into something that's unexpected? Like all of these things going, you know, I'm really good at playing through the worst case scenario in my head. So all of these things were going through my head and after about a week I called the editor and I was just like, I'm really sorry. I can't, man. Like, this isn't me. This is giving me way too much anxiety for what it's worth.
That whole scenario itself is going to be disabling to actually do what you do best.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's going to be a burden on how you operate on the day.
Yeah.
And it's telling. It's your mind and body and DNA telling you your focus should be somewhere else.
But also, it makes me feel bad. It makes me feel like I'm not a good enough journalist, photographer. I'm not dedicated enough because... Mm-hmm. You know, living in Beirut, you're surrounded by people who do go to Syria a lot and they do that kind of work where they're covering like risky stories. And a lot of my friends in the journalism community in Beirut had done that, a lot of that kind of work. And I just felt like saying no and getting anxious over that assignment. I felt like I was like a failure as a journalist. You know, I felt like maybe this isn't, you know, I don't know, man. I felt I didn't feel manly. I felt, you know, like, I don't know what I mean. Like, do you know, I just felt kind of like a failure, you know? I just have this weird feeling in my head that I can't get over sometimes that to make yourself as a journalist, you have to at some point cover conflict, which is not true. And a lot of my favorite journalists have never covered conflict. I just have that in my head because of who I looked up to when I was young, and I'm just trying to get over that because I don't know, it just is, it's not right. But
I think it feels like a classical traditional rite of passage,
yeah,
for
right.
a certain generation,
yeah. Because for so many journalists that's their rite of passage story. They may be doing fashion photography, or like Christopher Anderson, wonderful photographer, does fashion editorial stuff now but used to cover conflict, and so his rite of passage as a photographer is, oh, I used to cover conflict, then I moved away from it. And so I just have this, I keep saying I know it's wrong, but it's a weird instinct I can't get out of my head that's a rite of passage that all journalists have to take, which is misguided.
Well, what's an ideal scenario just to sort of lock this one in, to get away from the aspect of white guys explaining the world to the rest of us, yeah. Just, you know, as you said, being shipped or being dropped.
Yeah.
Like what's a better scenario to understand the world and the conflict?
I hope that a better scenario is, and I do think the journalism industry is moving away from that I think that's something that might have existed a lot before I was born, and maybe when I was young. But I think there's value in foreign correspondence for sure. But I think that increasingly local journalists who have been brought up in a country and understand much more about the nuance of it, I think their work is getting more recognized these days. There's a book called Our Women on the Ground. Zahra Hankir edited it, and it's a collection of essays by Arab women reporters. And I think that book...
There's a Libyan journalist there called Hiba Shibani. Featured one of... You featured the writer, actually.
We featured Asma Al-Khul on Kernan Cultures. Those kind of journalists are getting, I think, more recognition in today's journalism world. Maybe it's a byproduct of journalism budgets being cut, but it's a good byproduct of it. And I do hope that that going forward, people'll recognize the value of local journalists, which, you know, kind of before used to be the phrase local journalist, local photographer. Used to be a bit more like, oh, they're not that. That's an implication that they're not as good as the people that we're going to ship over from America or whatever. But I think now there's a recognition that local photographers and journalists have a much more nuanced perspective on things. I think that's coming more to the forefront. I mean, Kernan Cultures, man. I mean, I'm the only non-Arab on the team. You know, like everyone is local to where everyone covers stories about their home country.
Can we classically introduce Kernan Cultures? Also, like the meaning of the word, because I lack sort of my Webster knowledge is so very basic. So
Kernan Cultures, it started out as a single podcast, English language radio documentaries about the Middle East broadly. That was kind of Hiba's mission statement when she started it. And then that was going for about a year or so on its own as a single show. And then we got accepted, or Hiba and Razan, who's the co-founder, got accepted into an incubator in San Francisco called Matter, which is a media incubator. They help media startups, and they got some funding with that. And when they were there, there was this idea of like, well, why is it just a single podcast? Why don't you turn it into a network? And so after that, Hiba kind of started with this more ambitious idea of turning Kernan Cultures from a single podcast to a whole network. And that, so she started this kind of journey of pitching investors and raising money and all of that kind of thing, which took about, I think, a year maybe.
That's a massive accomplishment.
It's a massive accomplishment, yeah. And I can't claim any credit for it. Like, it was almost single-handedly Hiba. And so in March 2019, I want to say, we finished that round of funding and announced. And so that was us as the first, the first venture-backed podcast network in the Middle East, essentially. So the kind of, you know, Gimlet Media, kind of a similar approach where instead of one show, we wanted to make a whole host of shows. And now that's becoming a reality. We've released Jesedi in the last 2 months, I think, yes. Our first Arabic language show.
Yeah, a very lovely show that I'm promoting. We're cross-promoting each other because it really fits the idea of exploring yourself, self-awareness, and living better. And it's very concise, very well done. The way it organically features a variety of voices and stories, also a variety of dialects, and they blend in so well.
I wish I could listen to it and fully understand it, you know? I hope one day I'll get there.
Don't worry. Take my word for it. It's good.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. and then we have El Empire, which is our other English language show, and then we're releasing another few shows in the next few months. Yeah, so that now it's a network. So now Kernan Cultures means the network, essentially. We still do the English language show, which is called Kernan Cultures. That's like our flagship show, if you want to look at it that way.
Yeah. That's the one
increasingly. That's the one I work on.
You work on.
Okay. That's Kernan Cultures. It's pretty. I mean, I love the stories that we do that bring different countries and cultures and time periods together. So those kind of stories are my favorite, when we can cover a big, broad area. Some of which doesn't even include the Middle East, but it it puts the Middle East or a certain country in the Middle East in a kind of context that you didn't maybe know about it, or there's a history to it that you didn't know about, or it looks at how the world kind of fits into each other. I quite like that idea.
As far as you know, who's listening? Who's the audience?
So I think our top download countries are the US is our biggest one by far. And we think that's mostly diaspora. And then maybe a percentage of people from the US who are interested in the Middle East. And then our second biggest is Saudi Arabia. And then somewhere, I think the UAE, Lebanon is somewhere third. So that's kind of our listenership. So that's for our English show. For our Arabic show, I think Saudi is our biggest audience. The others is all in the Middle East for the Arabic shows.
Is there a thing with Saudi and podcast, or is it what's the connection there?
Well, I think Saudi is a big, I think it's a huge podcast market. It seems to be, at least. I mean, there's a huge potential listenership, mostly for Arabic content, I think.
Yeah, I know there's a few platforms as well.
Mustafa and a few others, but
I think there's good networks.
Yeah. Yeah,
but at the same time, in terms of listening culture, because I know they have a massive online content, the YouTube culture that's been going on for years.
And I think podcasting takes a slice of that. You know, I think that audience who are extremely YouTube fluent and like young, and I think that does translate over to podcasting, or it is starting to in a.
Does it have to do with good highways and driving culture?
Because it's US. It's a big thing. Like it's actually true. I mean, I think the UAE has the longest commute times of anywhere in the world.
UAE.
Or at least in the Middle East. There's a statistic somewhere that we found.
Like, where would you go from Dubai to where? Like,
Abu Dhabi Dubai. Yeah. Good. I think a lot of people do that commute. But
I imagine Saudi Arabia is much bigger. Also traffic jams.
So there's a lot of potential, like, you know, for people listening to long form stuff because they have an hour or 2 hours commuting every day.
Yeah, I keep trying to imagine, because I ask this to the listeners frequently. It's awkward saying my listeners. I feel like I possess them. I'm just the listeners. You guys are free. And a lot of people send me like snippets of video as they're driving. They're like, oh, I love this so much, even though the traffic is shit and I'm stuck in it. But like my mind is somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think there's something. We can't say we can crack it here for the UK because
more people walk and go on trains in the UK. So, I mean, I listen to most podcasts while I'm walking to work. It takes about 20 minutes. So
for the new audience that are listening to us now, hopefully there's usually two or three guys. It's not a massive audience. why should people listen? New audience? Why?
To Kerning Cultures.
Yeah. Yeah. What's there? What's in your bag for 2020? That's one. And what are the benefits of listening to podcasts and learn specifically yours?
So for us, I think 2020, we've got a ton of new shows coming up. And I think a lot of our production focus in 2020 for the team is going to be Arabic content. So we have, I think, two new Arabic shows coming out in the next like 3 or 4 months. One's a fiction show. Yeah. Which will be, I mean, maybe they haven't announced that yet, but I'm sure it's fine. One of them's another sort of documentary show similar to Jesedi, but around the theme of love. And then we have Kerning Cultures is as a show going to continue, and I hope always will. We've got I'm working on a lot of stories I'm really excited about at the moment.
There's one particular one that is very exciting.
The Sudan school one. I don't even know how to summarize the story. I've been talking to you about it.
Yeah.
Basically, so it's a story about, this is the big one that I'm working on at the moment, is about, it's about an old missionary, Christian missionary school in Khartoum. And, you know, it was opened in 1928. And then in 2011, it got a new head teacher. And in trying to find out some of the history of the school for a PhD project, uncovered a whole kind of decades of corruption and people, school administrators skimming money off the top of the school and running the school into the ground by doing so. And so when she found all of this evidence, I mean, literally documentary evidence, papers and receipts and like finance documents and and all of this, published it all online on a Blogspot. Like, and this is like 2011. So, and also I said, like, you know, the Blogspot is still there, and it looks like it was made in 2011, like, well, it looks like it was made in 2002 or something, but it's,
historical record. It's,
yeah. But she just published everything and wrote like all about the corruption on this blog, along with another one of the teachers, like completely outed all of her bosses and all of that. And that led to a big kind of court case and corruption scandal and all of this. And the story is like, I it's such an interesting story for me because we're doing it, you know, there's a lot of characters involved. We're interviewing the two teachers who did it mostly, but there's a lot of other people and there's a lot of investigating in this story. There's a lot of trying to track people down who we have their names and nothing else, and we're trying to talk to them about this thing that happened 5 years ago that they might not really want to talk to us about.
It sounds like it could go beyond an episode. It feels like, yeah, a Netflix series,
yeah, can you imagine? Uncovering. Yeah, there's this also very like mixed gray area in the story where it's like, what are the kind of what's the legacy of these missionary schools, and what you know, in trying to do good in their own way and their own kind of outdated sort of way, what problems have they caused in Sudan today? And this school has a lot of that, you know, there's a lot of gray area about whether or not it is even a good thing to exist, the school, and what its legacy is. And I find that kind of history really interesting as well. You know, I think it's a history that in the UK we don't recognize enough. History around colonialism and history around, you know, missionary schools and what the UK's legacy in other parts of the world are. I think that history is very, I don't know what the word is. It's very like, it's very misinterpreted, and it starts in school. And I love stories that change that. The very simple thing I think that most people fail to recognize around this is that I think the UK tends to look down upon countries that it used to colonize as broken third world. They have their own problems and they're unsolvable, and we tried, but we couldn't do anything about it. And I think what a lot of people in the UK fail to realize is that the UK caused a lot of problems that still exist in a lot of its ex-colonies today. And it's just weird how little recognition there is for that, you know? Like, there is a thing in the UK, a failure to recognize the real past of our country, and not just like, you know, how great the Victorians were. And I hope that this is a big aim in my documentaries and my storytelling. I hope going forward is that I really want to try and readdress some histories of the UK. And I like stories that touch on that, you know? And so this Sudan story is definitely one of those.
That's a really nice transition to the process, your process specifically as a producer, creating stories,
yeah,
journalistic audio-based stories. Which bit of the process, I know there's so many elements in order to make this come about, yeah, off the ground, like, but which bit does, which bit of it do you enjoy doing the most? You edit as well. So.
I do everything except, I mean, now we have Mo as a sound designer, so he handles all of our sound design now. I used to do a bit of sound design, but for me, I don't know, like, I think my favorite parts of it are, if you have a story where you don't know what the story is and you're finding a way through it, my favorite parts of it are interviewing people that you can't wait to interview because you actually don't know the answers that they're going to give you.
But in terms of your own process, do you script it and then, yeah, like you go hammer these questions out, or do you do a bit of sort of testing grounds?
We'll do a pre-interview before. Sometimes that can be 5 minutes, sometimes it can be like an hour, and that's just getting, you know, getting the person on the same page as you, so you know what they know, what you're going to ask them, they know what your story's about, and they feel comfortable like talking to you as well, and they know you're not going to throw curveballs at them unnecessarily. You know, before the story, we're figuring out, like, where's the tension in this story, what do we want the opener to be? For me, the opening is the most important thing, and I think every story, this is just me personally, but I think every story has to have a really good opening line, whether that's a narration or tape. I think the opening line always has to be great. And this Radiolab on Oliver Sipple, that episode where the story is about the person who tried to assassinate Lyndon Johnson, and they open it with this interview with this really sweet lady who is old lady, and you think that you know, she's like, I woke up that morning and I put on my, you know, my pleated skirt and red shoes, and I went down to the town square to watch Lyndon Johnson speak. And you get the impression that it's just this kind of sweet old lady who was in the audience. And then I pulled out the gun and I aimed it at him, and you're like, wait, what? Like, just like,
who's this crazy
you're
woman?
Like, how do you, wait, what is happening? Like, that's a crazy intro for a story. Like, it's the best, you know, that's a dream intro. So those, I think the intro to story is like, that's kind of my, I love a good intro.
It's a very decision making moment.
And I think if you have a good intro, you can, opening 5 minutes, if they're good, like, people will listen to the rest of it. They'll sit with you through the slow parts of the story.
Obviously, there is an element of this where it's your day. It's what you do on the day. This is a machine that sucks time and energy and everything. How do you deal with it? Like, how do you kick off your day first 60 minutes in order to get to a productive zone that, you know, by the end of this, everything on the list, all this first cut is going to be sent, you know, story, ingredients, pitch written. Like, how do you tweak your body in mind as soon as you start?
Question, man. I get up with my girlfriend. She goes to work at about 7:30. I get up about 7. I've stopped having coffee first thing in the morning, and that's helping a lot. I drink tea first thing, and then I have coffee like later in the day, but that helps. I felt a bit more calm in the morning, and then I'll walk to work. I'll make a decision to walk to work rather than getting the bus, because it gives me time to listen to something. I think most days I feel like I need to listen to something just to get the juices flowing. And so I'll listen to, you know, maybe the Daily from the New York Times, or if there's Radiolab, that, or This American Life, or 99% Invisible while I'm walking to work. And usually that'll start ideas going around my head, and I'll be like, oh, I can apply this in that story that I'm going to write today. And I find that always helps me remember why I love radio storytelling. Because, dude, sometimes I'm like, I hate this. I'm like, I can't figure out this story, and I don't even want to do this story. Like, it's rubbish. And like, I can get really like, oh, this just sucks. You know, it's not
part of the process, right?
Yeah. Like, but I think even just listening to like a well-written radio piece and whatever, it can be that simple. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Like, this is why radio is so exciting to listen to. Like, okay, I'm fine. Like, I'm just being a baby about it, you know? That's kind of it. I haven't figured out a routine yet.
No, but it feels like you're pacing yourself. You're very aware of, you know, the rhythm of your mind and body and the environment itself. So it kind of gradually gets there.
And I have to run a lot.
Every day?
At the moment, no, because it's freezing and horrible, and Brighton is so rainy and horrific. But I've had various sort of obsessions with running, and when I get into an obsession with it, I do it every single day, and it becomes so important to like just feeling good and like whatever. And when I lived in Dubai, I lived in the marina, or near the marina, which is like a big, exactly a 10K stretch. So like nearly every day I would run that, and it was perfect, man. Like when I'm in one of those like streaks of running every day, like it's just the best. Like I feel so much better about things.
I have about a 5-day streak now of running.
Oh, wow.
Not recently, not the past 2 days, because my wife is traveling, so I cannot escape the house and leave my daughter at home.
Yeah,
by herself. Although I'm so tempted, but I'm not gonna do it. but the feeling, like I really connect, like it does kind of set your mood.
Totally.
Yeah.
Also, it's just a completely manual thing. Like when you're sitting behind a computer all day and you're dealing with an electronic screen, it's like so nice to do something that's purely movement.
And also, it's mental cleansing, because you think as you run, but all these ideas kind of get recycled and gone, and then okay, you're
it
freer.
Helps so much.
Like it's resetting all the palates, all the senses.
Yeah,
it's not completely odd, but because we are people of many interests, and I'm sure there's something that you're interested in we haven't covered. If you were to speak at TED about something not relevant to podcasts, not relevant to photojournalism, but something you're very, very passionate, interested in exploring within a range of TED, which is 18 minutes, so a very concentrated speech. Yeah. What would the topic
I know what it would be because I want to do it. It would be the history of tattoos, the history of tattooing. That's one of my biggest side interests slash passions. And I do, you know, if I wasn't doing what I do, I like to think I would have become a tattooer.
I can see, but barely see, because I can't see them fully. Like, what
I
do
have
you got?
About 14 in total.
14. I can see a flower. I have
a little rose there. This is the one under my arm is like, I got it just after moving back from Lebanon. It's a little, it's on the side of all the coffee pots in Lebanon.
Ah, okay. It's can you flower. Lift it a bit for the camera? Oh, okay. It's like a, is it a rose or?
This one is it's a necklace that my mum and dad had back in the day. They had half each.
Nice.
This one is just Southwest. That's the part of the UK that I'm from. I love reading about the history of it because it's a very misunderstood history behind tattooing. And that I think the perception we have of it is that it's something that is for sailors and, you know,
tough
criminals
guys.
And tough guys and all that. But, you know, in fact, it has many different, you know, meanings around the world. And if you go back even just to the, you know, a few hundred years, Danish royalty had a lot of tattoos. It was considered something very high class in Europe. Like British royalty had tattoos.
Interesting. I had no idea.
Yeah. And then, you know, further than that, it goes back to kind of Pacific Islander culture and tattoos meant different things socially. And
I think
in Japan
there is like very elaborate.
Yeah, there's like a huge and really deep tattoo culture in Japan. And so now I think that we're in this new phase of tattooing where they're quite trendy and easily accessible, which is great. But I think the history, but there's still this weird thing where like our parents' generation, it's like tattoos are only for sailors and
very edgy.
And they're edgy and all that. And the history around like why people want to mark their bodies, because people have been doing it since the beginning of time. Like tattoos aren't a new thing. You know, the oldest found human remains thing, what's that, they gave a name to it, I've forgotten.
Is that a child or
no, it's a man. It's like the oldest human remains that we've managed to find. Or I'm giving a very bad example of this, but he had tattoos.
So why is it exciting for you? Why do you tattoo, actually?
I started getting tattoos when I was 17. I got this one on my hand. it was the initials of a band I was really into, punk band I was into.
Cool.
And then
very interesting location as well, like finger.
Well, my girlfriend at the time did it with a safety pin and ink. I was a cool kid. But then like in the last few years, the lead singer of that band was outed as basically a sexual predator and an abuser. So I got it crossed out with a black X. I started getting tattoos because I grew up listening to punk music and metal and all of that, and it was just part of the culture. I didn't really, you know, all of my favorite singers and bands had tattoos, so I thought it was cool. I still think it's cool, but I like it because it's a mark of who you were at a certain time, and you might not, you know, I wouldn't have got all of some of the tattoos I wouldn't get again now, but I wouldn't get rid of them. You know, they mark a time in my life, and I think that's cool. I like this idea of adding to it as you go.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost having an archive of your journey, very accessible locations.
I try and explain that to my mom, and she's like, doesn't get it at all. She's like,
but it's very inspiring, actually. It's very nice. I take it you're going to have a very busy PowerPoint, lots of pictures. On that TED Talk.
Maybe I should do this. This would be a great side project to do.
Yeah, I'd love to.
It's a really interesting field of study.
I'd love to see that video. anything else you want to add? I'm done.
Dude, no, thanks so much. I feel like I was actually pretty nervous when I came in because this is the first time I've been on a podcast that isn't Kerning Cultures. It's been fun, and I think you do a great job of what I always try to do, which is create a space where the person can talk openly and you know, it's a great space for it. I've learned about what it's like to be on this side of the microphone. so thanks a lot, man.
Yeah, my pleasure. It. Maybe one day I'll be on the other side.
Yeah, dude, I hope so.
That's from The Dimiri Show with Tore and Miri. It's a mostly Arabic show, but they have some English episodes too. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. That's Damiri, Dimiri. This version you heard here was edited by Tamara Rasemni and Dana Balut. We'll be back in a few weeks with more bonuses, so stay tuned for that. Thanks for listening. And while I'm convinced this holiday was invented by the greeting card company Hallmark, happy Valentine's Day.